Welcome back to Beholder to Know One, a TTRPG podcast. Today I'm here with Alex again, and we are going to talk about ways to improve combat, which is a very important conversation.
Indeed it is.
Not every system has combat, and I know that 5th edition is probably the one that's the most known combat system, which that definitely can improve. But in any game that has combat, period, there's so many ways you could just make it just a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
What are some things that you've noticed that like are common fail spots for combat in TTRPGs?
So I guess the most common, I mean, if we're just talking about D&D in general, the most common thing that I run into or see a lot of times is that fighting is usually organized on a field that is flat, not really any sort of terrain or anything, and then there's the players and then the monster, and that's, and then they just whack it for 2 hours and then it dies.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Like whenever we did 5th edition games, specifically because that's the game we were playing, whenever you flew up, there's like, okay, there's a Z in there now. I don't know how to do the math for X, Y, and Z. Like, that's not possible in D&D.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people really enjoy the combat phase, but I think that there's a lot of ways that you can make it really, really interesting for everybody. So you can engage those players that are into heavy combat, but you can also engage the players that are much more into narrative focus.
Yes. And I think one thing that makes games for me is when you take that combat and you go into the detail of how you're actually doing it. And that's what makes or breaks combat for me. Because it's one thing to just like, I run up and hit it. And it's another thing to describe where you're running to, how you're sliding under them or behind them, and to stab them in the back and like pull upwards. Or like, those are two very distinct things, which that puts me more into the story. It helps visualize actual goings-ons of the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that can definitely help a lot. The other thing that I would suggest that people take a look into in combat is not only having those descriptors, but also making the, if you're going to use miniatures or a map or something like that, for a game like D&D, it's kind of necessary when it comes to combat, just because of the length of time that it can take. But adding elements into it that the players can interact with does add a ton of depth and flavor. So you can have a hill or maybe a pile of random stuff or some water or something like that, because nothing is ever flat most of the time. Even in a dungeon, you can add like pillars and pulpit or all sorts of different things that players can move around and work with, which I would also suggest to, when you're designing that, your dungeon, I would also design it around what the other party is going to be, because I would also suggest that you make your opposing groups an actual mixed group of characters. So you have things that do different stuff, bring different powers, all sorts of things like that. So it makes it more dynamic. And then adding the terrain in also makes it so not only can the players take advantage of the terrain, use it for cover, use it to plan ambushes, but if the players do have some sort of ability or something like that that would synergize well with a piece of terrain, like some sort of athletics ability, like let's say normally they would use to jump from building to building. Well, now you can add in this other element into the battlefield that makes it so that person that's playing the rogue can feel much more roguelike as they dart around through the terrain and then come down behind something. Like, it makes it a lot more interesting when you add these different elements into it. You can even think of it like from the perspective of a tactical war game, like a miniatures war game. Mm-hmm. In a miniatures war game, it's not flat. There's always stuff to interact with, stuff that throws off line of sight, provides you cover, does different things. And that really kind of shapes how the game goes. And you can do the same thing in a combat in any sort of tabletop role-playing game.
Yeah, and I think it's fun to let the players add something to the game that will affect combat to a point. Like, you obviously don't want to be like, there's suddenly a rock avalanche that I could just hit and make happen. But like, if you're in a bar, the stereotypical things in a bar will exist, so therefore use the world around you to create a better combat situation. Throw a table up and turn it over, grab a knife off the thing, throw a bottle at them, like, do something from the surroundings, and that also adds to it.
Absolutely, because, like, a lot of times in games, you don't necessarily have to, the end result doesn't necessarily have to be that you kill the thing. You can have the thing get away. You can have the thing run. You can have the thing yield. And having those different elements throughout the fight really enables that, because if you have like a keg or something that you can throw at a character and incapacitate them, that might then lead to another player being able to follow up with that and, you know, get them to yield or something like that.
Yeah. I think another thing that adds to the story and to the combat is to ensure that everybody has something they can do to help. Not every fight will be necessarily perfect for everybody in the situation, but if you throw something at the group that only a mage can hit and do damage, and nobody else can hit it, that's not really fair unless you know that they have tactical ways or give them options that could be used to help them still fight in that condition. So this comes up a lot with like flyers, when you have non-flyer characters and then you have flyers, the only people can do anything are mages and people with a bow and arrow. But like you have your barbarian and your fighter who isn't as more melee in the ground, or your monk, and they're like, I can't do anything. Like, you just took out two of your party members, which makes this a significantly more difficult battle.
Yeah, and I think that that also comes back to really a takeaway in any game, is that you should always make it so that your players get a chance to feel cool no matter what it is that they do. You should engineer something that they can interact with. It doesn't have to be very direct, like there's a locked door. It can be something like with a rogue being like, okay, so here's an opportunity that you can go in to take care of this thing. You can use your rogue abilities to try and sneak past this one thing, or you can go in and do this other thing. Like, it, offering people multiple avenues while still enabling the characters to feel cool is really what you want to do to keep everybody engaged, because at the end of the day, if they're having fun, most likely you are also having fun.
Yes, I agree. I think also, like, mix it up. Don't just throw one creature at them all the time. Like, it's fun for like boss battles. It's fun for like more severe things. You just want to throw a very difficult one creature. But sometimes it's fun to throw hordes at people and just mix it up a little bit, whether or not you have to use different types of monsters or not. That would be fun as well. If you're doing D&D, don't just throw a bunch of goblins, throw goblins and hobgoblins and bugbears into the max, because they would work together, and see what kind of army that becomes. But also, like, if you want to do a game where the focus is roleplay, also offer the option of that aspect. Like, not every fight has to end in death. It's up to the players ultimately, but give them the wiggle room that they need to make combat more interesting by letting someone give up, or let them run away, or let them be persuaded out of fighting because they realize they're losing.
Mm-hmm.
And that also, like, that's a more recent thing for me, but I absolutely love it because it changes the story completely. And there is the risk that you just still have an enemy that's just wanting to go recover, but there's also the risk that you just made a friend in that fight because you gave them a chance.
Yeah, and I mean, that really comes down to asking the person running the game, are they comfortable with exploring this sort of dynamic, having characters that were enemies turned to friends and things like that, and having these different characters that bring that sort of feeling to the party and things like that. Like, that can be somebody who then becomes a friend, be somebody who then becomes a close contact or something like that. Again, if you are comfortable with exploring that and comfortable with your players realizing that that is also a possibility that could happen.
Yeah, that mostly came up when it was like, there was one player specifically, Ellen, in my Monday game. She always wanted to talk it out before fight violence. Like, she didn't want to fight innocent people. She would always try to see the best in people and try to talk to them and say, hey, we don't want to fight. Is it okay? We just came here for this. Can we just go by? Can we just walk around? We're not here to hurt you. Knowing full well that if they fought, that these people may die, and they didn't want that on their conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, it led to some very interesting stories, but my absolute favorite story that it led to was when which I think I've mentioned before, but whatever, was when the player that used to be in the group left, their character became a power-hungry character who was doing some things to get magic from gods. Like, they were siphoning the magic from the gods. And there was a minuscule chance that this person could be persuaded out of doing this. But Ellen pulled out all the stops. Like, she pulled in backstory reasons and, like, remember when you taught us how to do this? And I wrote some poetry because you taught us how to do it. And here, and, like, was reading poems that Ellen actually created for each character that was in their party. And that was enough for me to give her the persuasion check versus an insight check. And Ellen won by 1 point.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like 26 versus 27. And I'm just like, holy crap. Like, how did you do that first off? And while that succeeded at getting them to stop, they realized they couldn't stop the siphoning because now the god was starting to awaken and realize what was happening. So when they realized they couldn't pull themselves away and realized they were not in control anymore, they gated themselves out of that plane of existence so they could break the spell. But that meant this god was still released, but there is an ally there now. They have that brief moment in their head where they are still allies. They still care about these people. And if they ever run into each other again, which they will if we ever play that game again, there is going to be a interesting dynamic between a quarter of a god living inside their head and then them trying to still protect their friends that protected them. And that would have never happened if I was just like, nope, you can only fight.
Yeah. And I think that's really, like, it really comes down to, is this a thing that you want to do? Is this a thing that your players want to do? Because, you know, offering them that other alternative is always great. But at the same time, you may have a group of people that don't want that at all. But, you know, that's something that you would discuss prior, I feel like.
Yeah. And in this situation, we had discussed multiple times that in character and out of character that you wanted to try to convince DS to, or Dias to, like, come back to their side, to stop doing what they were doing. They were going down a dark path. Like, out of character, she's like, I'm taking skilled on persuasion so I can make sure to have the best chances I possibly can. And, like, so we knew that it was coming up. And some of the other characters stated in character when this doesn't work, because they didn't think it was the right move or they didn't think it was going to work, period. When this doesn't work, you have to be okay with us fighting. And she admitted, like, that's fine, but I have to try.
Yeah.
So that's usually how it went. And that was kind of a prior conversation where she's like, this character will always try to not fight if possible, which led to some problems. And it led to mostly her getting hurt in the process because she wouldn't attack until she was attacked.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one way to go about it. Like, if that's the kind of character you want to play, then that's totally fine. Again, as long as everybody knows what's going on, that I don't see any issue with that.
Communication.
Mm-hmm.
Always. I know that in non-D&D games, there isn't always combat, but even in games that, like, prefer roleplay and have combat, there's still ways that you can do that in an intriguing way that when you have to be subtle, but you're still wanting to attack.
Yeah.
Vampire probably is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, I mean, combat in Vampire is, I think, a bit different from a lot of games where in Vampire, you getting into combat is usually something that happens very quick. It's not something you usually play out for a long period of time, just because everything is so deadly. I think another good example, even really combat-heavy games, for example, something like Zweihänder or Warhammer Fantasy or the old Warhammer 40K games, a lot of those had very big foundings in combat and, you know, violent outcomes to things. But even in those, the way that they would approach that is that your characters would have these different abilities and these different things that they can do and these different specialties that they can do to really make them feel more alive and make them feel more dynamic. Also, the terrain would come up in that as well. You would make these maps and things like that where there was a lot of terrain that would affect the way the combat played out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely true. And there are games where combat is super frowned upon and you're just trying to, like, dodge and weave your way out of it. I think like one game I do like the combat system is Monster of the Week, because it's not super combat oriented, because the goal is to try not to do that, but like also there's monsters, so you also have to fight some a lot of times. But fighting doesn't always help.
Yeah.
As my character proves multiple times. But it's always interesting to see what options there are and what different types of magics you can do or different types of things you can do to turn the tables. And I like when that happens in a multitude of games. I'm trying to think of another game that does something similar to that. I am blanking on every game I've ever played. Oh, RuneQuest. Let's go with RuneQuest. So I played RuneQuest for the first time last night as of the time of recording this. And I had no fucking clue what was happening at first. Like, I really had no idea what the system was like. I was very confused. And they had magic and they had runes, and like the magic, all of the magic spells that my character had, because it was a pre-gen, were like focused on either her becoming a better talker or her reflecting magic back and nobody was using magic, or her trying to do something that would trick people with illusions, which didn't work on the creatures that they were fighting. So as I learned more about the how to play the game, I learned you can, she was a rune painter, and I learned that, oh, hey, I can actually use these runes to cast things. So then like a whole new world opened up, and I had to think defensively, which normally I think offensively with fighting. So I had to figure out, how can I make snow using my water element into something that can protect my allies? So I cast a spell saying I want to protect my allies, drawing the rune on her arm. And then when she cast it, and the DM described it, and this was how I like it finally clicked in my head, that a ice arm, light ice armor basically rushed over all of their bodies, and they got plus two armor for about like a minute or something like that. And it was just different ways I could use the elements around me, including like death and not just water, to change the scene of battle and to help my allies actually fight things, because I couldn't get into combat. I would die.
Yeah. And I think games that explore more of that lethality tend to have a more dynamic combat system built in them, simply because the players don't want to run out in the middle of everything and fight something. It's usually not a great idea in a lot of cases. Probably the best example I can think of is in Delta Green, when you fight things, you most typically want to take advantage of things like cover, terrain, distance, all these different things to kind of prolong your life, simply because if the thing gets to you and it's, you know, a monster or something like that, the chances of you being able to go toe to toe with it are pretty slim. So having these different elements built in there where lethality is more of a concern, I think makes it so that people tend to be a little bit more creative when it comes to how they fight something.
Right. What's one of your favorite fight scenes that you remember? What, either something you did or something a player did in one of your games?
Oh, that is a good question. So probably one of my favorite fight scenes was in a game I did at Gen Con, where I played with a few playtesters for a game. It was called Only War, which was a Warhammer 40k game that you play as a bunch of guardsmen. So basic dirtbag humans armed with weapons fighting horrible monsters most of the time. And in our game, we were fighting, I think we were fighting mutants or something, but we had a really cool and dynamic combat going on because it was in the middle of a city area. So we were running around this warehouse yard and dodging between crates and stuff like that, and using the terrain to our advantage. One point we blew up some Promethium tanks, which is like their fuel, basically, that kind of tipped the scales for us. And I thought that that was a lot of fun to participate in, because it really made the characters feel cool and really made us look for these different avenues, which I think is something you can do too, is if you're going to have a game where it's very combat centric like that, making the players face a scenario where it is difficult or impossible unless they can engineer a way to do it is, I think, is a really neat idea. You obviously have to have faith in your group that they're going to figure it out, but if they do, it, you know, feels super cool.
Yeah. One of my favorite moments was actually with one of my characters, and I don't think I've mentioned this on the show before, which is actually kind of shocking, but there was a scene, and this wasn't a favorite moment because of it being epic. This was a favorite moment because it fit the character so fucking perfectly. She went to go see her family. This is based off Tari, my Kalistar monk, and her family has been in protection for years. So she went to go see them, and the person they were with was like, wait a moment, the light didn't change. It's supposed to be a different color. That means something went wrong. Like, the guards weren't switched out on like they were supposed to be. There might be people inside. Let me go sneak over and check. Tari isn't known for her patience. So as soon as she saw somebody walk out of the back door that was not her family, she waited like 2 seconds before rushing in into attack, which was a bad idea. It was a terrible idea. So she didn't see the other person that was with him, who stabbed her in the back and left a bleed effect for an ultimate total of like 20 HP. So she's fighting and she's like, she sees her brother and she's like, don't worry, I got this. I've taken down bigger and stronger men. No way I'm going down. No absolute way. And then she goes down. And she's fed a healing potion and she gets back up and she's like, it's okay. It's okay. I'm good. And the beginning of her turn, she takes 20 HP bleed damage and goes down. And nothing they did would give enough HP to keep her up. They couldn't roll more than 20. And this happened like 4 times. Just the up and down, up and down, up and down. And the warlock, who was the one that snuck in, had to rush in, grab her, and teleport out of the room and just healed her. And was like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And she's like, they were in danger. Like, they were sleeping. And then she pushes herself up off the ground, drinking a healing potion, and she's not even fully healed yet, and she just starts walking back to the place because she's like, no, I'm protecting my family no matter what. And the person's like, at least let me heal you. So she heals her a little bit more, and I sneak up and I get a good hit in and end up killing one of them. But for 4 rounds, the other player was by himself, using every single spell slot basically to keep himself up. And I finally got back in and was able to help finish them off, except for one, which I was going to kill. And then the person stopped Tari from killing him, because if all of them died, they would know they found the right place. So it was just like her pure stubbornness and like, I don't care if I'm down, I'm going back in there. I don't care if I'm going to die. I'm going to protect my family at every last ounce of my breath. And it was just like a beautiful moment, but also like, she realized that, hey, maybe some people are stronger than her, even though she won't admit it. So it's kind of like an eye opener for her, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hello. Sorry for the interruption here, but I wanted to give you an advertisement for one of our friends in the tabletop community. Please give it a listen and go check them out.
Sometimes, winning a game isn't about dealing the most damage, or drawing the most cards, or making any measurable contribution towards victory. But hey, just because you don't have the stats doesn't mean you're not a f***ing gamer god, alright? Enter The Intangibles, a podcast on the Geekspective Network, where me, Kenny, and my brother Matt break down all the things that are hard to quantify in games. All kinds of games. We're talking classics like Sonic's the Hedgehogs, and chess, and 3D Pinball Space Cadet. Great game, by the way. We're talking new releases like
insert latest trending games on Twitch here,
single player, co-op, competitive, card games, board games, role-playing games, play-by-mail games, the wakes. We do deep dives into our favorite games, digging into the intangibles that make them great and the intangibles that will make you a better player, and hey, maybe even a better person. Check out The Intangibles on whatever the heck platform you're listening to right now.
to the show. Do you prefer theater of the mind or using a grid-based system?
I guess it depends. Is the game combat focused? Is that a big portion of the game?
I mean, it could go either way. If I know that, like, for me, I prefer using a grid for like D&D, but I don't necessarily need a grid for like Tapestry, which is purely a roleplay focused game.
Yeah, I would say it really depends on the context of the game and what it is that it's focused around. In something like, I guess, D&D or Pathfinder or one of the 40K games or something like that, or Spyhander, I could definitely see the use of a map being beneficial. I don't think it's absolutely necessary. I think you can always do theater of the mind. And most of what I do is theater of the mind. It's just what I prefer. But I mean, I can see the benefits of both. They both bring a lot to the table. And especially if it's something that you're going to spend a long time on, like longer than 20 minutes, you should probably have some sort of map or grid or something to show what exactly is happening so everybody can follow along. Because eventually people will just start to forget.
Honestly, that's my issue with specifically D&D games. But like, there was, we were doing a game where it was all theaters of the mind and people are rushing around. And I'm just like, okay, I moved and somebody else moved. Where the fuck is everybody right now? Like, I don't know how far anybody is. I don't know what spells they can cast. I have no visualization on where anybody is or anything is. People are up in trees. I don't know if I'm even up in a tree. Like, what is happening? I'm so confused. And you can't interrupt in the middle of a fight to be like, hey, I know you're on their turn, but how far is that person right now? 60 feet? Okay, cool, 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 cool. Oh, now they're 80 feet. Crap. Okay. Like,
yeah.
So then the first half of your turn, when you're like planning, what do I want to do, which you're supposed to do when it's not your turn, becomes near impossible because you can't see on the map exactly where everything is. Even if it's just like squiggles, just like there have been maps that I literally just drew with dry erase marker, basic boundaries, just so there were people and as like a circle for a tree or something like that. And that was it. And it worked.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the whole thing with terrain and stuff like that, that's really more of like a grid based thing. I think you can have terrain in theater of the mind combat, but it probably shouldn't be a wide open space. It should probably be something smaller that's easier to follow.
Right, or where distance doesn't matter.
Right.
Like with vampires, for example, like you can get up on top of them instantaneously pretty much, so.
Yeah, or in Delta Green, most of the time, your weapons are going to reach most of the scene that you're in. They might have different ranges if they're more lethal. And, you know, you can say that you're moving closer to get to that point, but overall, you don't need to spend a whole lot of time moving around to be in an effective range if you're using just a regular projectile weapon.
That's fair. What are your thoughts about stealth combat? Like, we're not talking rogues here, but we're talking like poisoning somebody in mid-conversation in a party type thing, or doing something while somebody's sleeping.
I mean, I think it can add a lot. It adds a sense of urgency to the situation. It's something that you can use as either just to get people going, or a story driver to introduce a new villain or something like that, or throwing the players on edge when they thought previously that they were safe. So, I mean, I think it's a good thing to have in your arsenal. It doesn't necessarily have to even equal, it doesn't even need to really result in a large combat. It can be something that happens really stealthily and then the person gets away. And now instead of it being more combat focused, it's now become the situation that you have to deal with and you're put on a timer.
That, I like the timer options, especially like chase scenes. I fell in love with chase scenes recently. Because you just throw obstacles in people's way and it's still combat oriented because you're like trying to weave and dodge and run. Which is all technically part of combat because you're trying to catch this person, but there's always an opportunity for them to get away or for you to lose line of sight. And that urgency kind of amps up the threat a little bit because they were your like last connection to the person you needed to talk to. So I think that's always fun too.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you can think of about combat that we haven't talked about?
don't be afraid to explore things that are potentially deadly. Having something present that is a constant reminder that things could go very poorly very quickly is not always a bad decision. It makes it so that people tend to be a little bit more on their toes. Because, you know, eventually party, or if you're fighting just a group of goblins, that's going to get pretty boring, because the chances of you getting killed by said group of goblins in D&D is pretty slim. But if they had something that was more powerful at their disposal than maybe that they were trying to get working, or wasn't up to its full potential, or whatever else, that's also a thing that you can throw in to kind of add some expediency to the player's experience, but also give them that feeling of accomplishment when they do overcome it.
Yeah, that is definitely true. I love throwing in deadly battles, and 99% of the time, like, people were like, oh, you're a deadly DM. I'm like, you don't have to fight them all. That is the point. You can run. If you're losing, you can run. Also, I think as a DM, a way to make it more interesting is to give the bad guys a personality, and like, you need to know why they're doing this. Maybe something happens in the battle that they see something and that like clicks, like, what am I doing? Or maybe they have a fear that if they get hurt enough, they need to run, they need to leave now. Or if they see fire, like, they're afraid of fire. Like, add story to it, but also, like, there's possibilities where it's like, oh, if you threaten their kids for whatever reason, they will go full blown death mode. There's no chance for you to escape this now. Like, we are fighting. I think adding those little words and the way people word things or how they respond and react also adds to it, because there are going to be things that are going to be like, nope, I'm done. I'm fucking done. I'm kicking your ass. Let's go.
Yeah. And I mean, that's always good to have, is these real reactions. I might also, if the players want to get into their characters to that level, like, that it's very easy to do. You can add this sense of urgency and the sense of oneness with your character that you can really exploit as the person running it.
Right. And I know, like, with Tari, hers was her family straight up. Like, if her family was threatened verbally at all or insulted in any way, she would immediately go on the defense. Like, no questions asked, wouldn't matter if it was a real threat or not. She would just immediately defensive position. I'm going to punch them right now. Where other characters are more like, meh, okay, have fun. And didn't affect them at all.
Yeah.
So I think we talked about combat enough.
Okay.
Because there's a thousand things that could probably be said, but we can't think of them. So if you think of questions, people, please leave it on this Twitter post that is announcing this, and we can maybe do a second combat. I don't know. Maybe. We'll see. So instead, let's talk about other things, like, I don't know, some cool things that are coming up in the near future.
Sure.
About Dice Before Dawn.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you want to go over?
Well, first and foremost, I want to, I guess, officially announce that Dice Before Dawn was picked up by Novi Studios and is coming live approximately in April. We have a month. I can't tell you a day yet, but April, early April, is the current goal to get episode one out. And I'm so excited.
Me too. I'm very much looking forward to bringing this show, and I'm really, really excited for 2022 and the different things that we're going to explore with it.
Yes. I have already planned out the full 2022 calendar, because I have a problem and I know it's not going to work out that way, but that's okay. I have high hopes.
I think it'll be good. I mean, we've already got some games laid out that we're going to play, as well as some plans or some future ones. I would really like to have this take off and start to explore the world of horror tabletop RPGs and things like that, and these darker themes that I think for a lot of people, they maybe may not know about.
Yes. For those who don't know, Dice Before Dawn will be purely focused on darker story settings like Vampire the Masquerade, Werewolf, Delta Green, Morkborg.
Yeah. Morkborg, technically, but yeah.
I don't know how to pronounce it, but games that maybe aren't just like always the calmest and not super brutal games.
Yeah, we'll also have some one-shots, too, that we'll explore with things like Alien Cult and, oh, I just blanked on its name.
Cult is scary, guys. It's real scary. It's great, but it's terrifying.
I personally, for those of you that don't know, by the time this has gone up, you might have already seen that Nikki was actually in a one-shot for a cult game.
Yeah, it's on YouTube now.
Yes.
I'll put the link down below.
It was ran by Penny for a Tail, or I think it's technically under Weave for a Tail. What are they?
Weave the Tail.
Weave the Tail, excuse me. By Penny for a Tail Network. And that was Nikki's first foray into cult, and it really got me thinking, because this is kind of a thing that for a lot of people, when they explore dark games, there are certain ones that people tend to avoid. Cult is not one that people avoid, but it is very severe. Mm-hmm. But after that, I really kind of ran with the idea of making either short campaign or a one shot for it.
Yes, I will play 1000%. I had fun. Also, there was like super fantastic safety tools put into place to make sure everybody felt safe and protected. And that made it even better, because that meant if it got too bad or I freaked out too much or whatever the case may be, I was able to take a break or leave the situation for a second. And they checked in regularly. So those would be the same things that would be taking place in our games.
Absolutely. Every one of our games will come with a warning at the beginning stating certain themes might be present. Also, do know that while our players will have safety tools built in that will be in the background, they won't be apparent to the audience. So if you do know that there might be something that's coming up that might bother you, or if that particular theme doesn't sound like something you would be into, you know, that's okay. But I would say give it a shot. Give it a listen. We're going to have lots of cool stuff coming out with it. And if you enjoy games that are horror or those darker themes, it's definitely something I would recommend.
Yeah. I am super enjoying the vampire game so far, and I'm really excited to get into depth with my character's bestial side to see what happens, because I haven't figured that part out yet in my brain.
No, that's okay. You won't really have much of a choice in what you do anyway.
Fair point. I know that we planned Vampire the Masquerade, which is Phoenix by Night. And if all goes as planned, intros will begin releasing in, I believe, early March for 5 weeks before the actual first episode releases. And you'll get to see little short stories about each of the characters and how they became part of this. What is the C word?
How they became kindred. Yeah.
Right. How they became kindred in this world. Some, like myself, has been quite a few years, and others are brand new baby vampires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it'll be a really neat way for people to get in. Even if you've never played Vampire the Masquerade, it's a really neat way of getting into the characters, just because when you build a character in Vampire the Masquerade, you building them as a human is actually your first step. So having people have some sort of identification of who this person was prior to them becoming a kindred is important.
Mm-hmm. And then after that, we'll have a mini series, which for now I'll keep secret because it needs secrets for the future. But that will be the first game I am not going to be a part of on my own podcast, but that's okay. I kind of need a break, I guess, sometimes. So, but I'm really excited to hear it and like see what other people come up with. And I have played that particular game in the past and it was a great game, but I'm excited for it so far who we have planned for that. Though, no, nobody, I'm not telling you anything. You can't pull it out of me. Nope. Secret. I'm going to be good this time and not tell any secrets. Yeah, I'm very excited for that, and that means our Dice Before Dawn Twitter will become more active because it's been a little dead.
Yeah, but I mean, now that we'll have things to post with and interact and promote, I think that'll be I know I myself will be engaging on it a lot more and using it a lot more and really promoting our stuff, because what I would really like to see Dice Before Dawn also kind of dip their toes into is I would really like to start previewing other horror games that are coming out. Like if something is getting released, having that capability of saying, hey, you know, we'll run a game on our podcast and, you know, being able to promote it and stuff like that. Find projects that we really enjoy, because I personally am very much about exploring new games and learning new stuff. And I think that there's a lot of people that are very much the same.
1000%. That's why I have Beholder to One Shot, because I just wanted to play all the games. It's like, mm-hmm. You have a new indie game? Please give me. Let me play it. And most of them have been fantastic. Like, honestly, I can find a good thing about every single one of them that I played. Some of them aren't necessarily my cup of tea because I don't like that particular style of game, but doesn't mean it was a bad game at all. And some of them I will talk about constantly to people that I'm like, oh, you want a game? Well, have you tried Lewd Grannies?
Mm-hmm.
You should try it. You should, yeah, I know it sounds dirty, but it's not. Kind of. But if, like, those are my favorite types of things to do. And that's why I've been loving being on Weave the Tales lately more and more, because I get to try these games that I've never got to play before. And I have no knowledge of the game before jumping into them sometimes until like 15, 20 minutes prior to the game. And I'm like, okay, cool, let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, you can't tell I don't know what I'm doing all the time. So I win if you can't tell that I don't know what I'm doing.
It's just a general guide of being a GM in general, is just bumbling your way through stuff and hopefully everybody has a good time.
Yeah, that's just my GMing style. Should just be, don't know what I'm doing, plus Google. I think the way I worded it in a zine article that's coming out soon was whether you're someone who has to plan out every single step in your world so you have it prepared and don't need to think on the spot, or you fly by the seat of your pants with a wing and a prayer and Google on your side.
Mm-hmm.
Which is exactly my style, because Google will lead me to weird things that will lead to very interesting stories. But yes, so I'm very excited about Dice Before Dawn, and I'm so excited that it's finally coming out officially, and you get to see the beautiful artwork that was created, because it is so good. So good.
Mm-hmm. I am very happy with it too, and I'm not even in it.
We need to get a DM one.
I have some ideas.
Write them up, we'll chat. And now I can connect you to the artist. But yes, so Dice Before Dawn officially coming out in April 2022. Sound Control RPG will also be going live in 2002, though I don't have specific dates for that one yet. So as soon as I know them, I will share them with you all. That one does not involve Alex, though, sadly. So I'll have to be talking to somebody else when I announce that, or just be me. I don't know. Who knows? We'll see. Mm-hmm. I'll figure it out. I didn't plan on announcing that today, so whatever. I don't plan for shit. That's a lie.
It works out.
Yeah. Yeah, I plan for like all the wrong things, and then I don't plan for like the exciting things. I'm just like, I need to tell you the news right now. It's so exciting. Go. And then things that are like mundane, I'm like, must plan every detail out. I have a problem, guys. The solution evidently is more Excel files.
Yeah.
But other than that, if you are also wanting to see more things on Beholder to No One, we will be having an Academia game coming up in a couple of months. I don't know the title yet, so I won't give too much away, but it will be between season 1 and 2 of Morning Blues. And I am excited for that one too, because my character is phenomenal. She is amazing. That's all I'm gonna say.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see what comes out with that too.
Yes. It is amazing what you can find on Homebrew, guys. Like, seriously, the Homebrew subclasses on D&D Beyond, some of them are phenomenal. And just like, thank you. Yes, that's what I want to do. Please. I'm trying to think. What else? In the future, I believe it is February 18th, you can find both of us on Weave the Tale for a game of Blue Rose.
Yes, I am very excited about that.
Yes, I am as well. One of us or both of us or whatever might be on games in between then, because they just kind of pop up sometimes and I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. Which is what happened to the RuneQuest game last night. I agreed 12 hours prior or 24 hours prior.
I mean, it works.
Yeah. And the Blue Rose game I'm excited for because it's fantasy romance queer, basically. Fantasy queer romance.
Yeah, it's very romance heavy. It's how it's described. And there are a lot of rules. If you haven't read through Blue Rose or seen much on it, it is a fantasy romance game, which they take in multiple meanings. Fantasy romance from the perspective of there is romance and connection built into the game, which has a whole separate set of rules to it. But it's also the idea of these romantic fantasies such as Tolkien and stuff like that, these more classic fantasies. And that's kind of how the characters and the stories are presented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like a really fun game. And I'm really excited to play with the people that are in our group, all of which I have played with before, which is cool, honestly. Well, have we played in a game as players together before?
Yeah, we played in Spyhander.
Oh, right. You weren't. My brain was thinking you were the GM for that, because you would be a good GM for that. But Adam was the GM, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yes, Adam was the GM for Zyhander.
Bad memory. I'll put that one in the description too. But yes, that one we did get to play together. But usually you are GMing, or I am GMing.
Yeah, most of the time.
Which is the fatal flaw of being GMs. You usually can't play in the games together. I run into this issue with my friend Bill too. One of us is always the GM, so when we do get to play together, we're like, yes, this will be chaos and amazing. But yeah, I think those are all the announcements I have, unless you have anything you want to share.
No, I think you pretty much went over everything that I've got coming up. Got more stuff coming on the horizon, which I'm excited about, and we'll post both on mine and as well as posting on Dice Before Dawn if it's stuff that we're doing there.
Yeah, which will also be retweeted on Beholder to No One. So you can find it in all the places. But if you want to hear more about either of those, definitely go follow Dice Before Dawn and follow Beholder to No One and go follow Alex. Alex, yes. Where can they find you?
So you can find me on most social media platforms. I am on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok under @AlexTheDM89. Pretty much on all those, I just post random tabletop RPG stuff. You can feel free to post to me, ask any questions. I'd be happy to talk to you, be happy to help you in any way. One of the things I have been doing a lot with friends of mine recently, and happy to do this with anybody, is listening to story pitches and, you know, kind of helping them out a little bit, making them sound good, making them look good, everything else like that. So yeah, follow me on Twitter. That's mostly where I post. And you'll see my stuff on there as well as some of my streaming stuff.
Yeah, they play spooky games.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I play mostly spooky games and adventure games. And that happens every Monday and Wednesday night at 6:30 Pacific Standard Time. Usually runs for about an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Fantastic. So you heard them. Go follow every link down below. All of them. I expect reports back. No, I'm kidding. But yes, go follow all the links down below. And if you want to talk to me more, you can find me at Beholder to No One, or probably on Dice Before Dawn or Sound Control RPG. You can also find me on Fridays, usually. Not this Friday, though, but next Friday on 2000 Tales, where we play Weird Web and I play Karen, the once ghost, now turned demon, turned undead human who suddenly has a heartbeat and she's very confused. And also you can, as of the 21st, which was 2 weeks ago, you can listen to Tower of Souls on Awfully Queer Heroes podcast, where I am the DM there and I get to do deadly encounters a lot. And it is fun. It's very fun to mess with the players, honestly. They are so jumpy for some reason. It's very strange. I have no idea why. But that is all from me. So keep being awesome. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, before you go, I just wanted to let you know that this episode was edited by Matt over at Walsh Animation. They are part of the Table Party podcast, and I wanted to give a little bit of a shout out to them, especially because Matt has been such a freaking lifesaver when it comes to editing the discussion episodes recently. So please listen to this ad for Table Party podcast and go check them out and make sure you give them some love. Thanks.
What makes Table Party different from other tabletop podcasts?
The music.
The setting.
The characters.
The gore.
A bunch of different games.
The refreshing coldness of ice cream.
The 300-foot-tall squid named Delilah.
The dice rolls.
The horrifying body horror.
The aroma.
The suffering of my players.
Dairy Queen blizzards.
The luxurious plush texture.
The free coupons.
Bad decisions.
And who can we expect?
I'm Kelsey.
I'm Matt.
I'm Gabe.
I'm Walsh.
I'm Chris.
Welcome to the Table Party.
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 Welcome to the Table Party.